The Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks, everyone. I'm your host, John Lossworth. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
So, guys, I'm thinking after this podcast, we should maybe start a garage, because my pockets ain't empty, cuz.
Yeah. And John Levengood.
Cheers. Just having a sip of a Belgian ale in celebration of National Kurt Russell Day.
Guys, I feel like you guys are referencing something. You guys... Mind explaining to me what you guys are referencing right now?
I wouldn't be too fast,
okay,
or too furious to jump into assumptions.
Right.
It's not always being about fast, Mark. Right now, it's about being furious.
Are you guys giving me clues right now?
We are here to discuss Mrs. Doubtfire today. Clearly,
I knew it.
You know, we live our lives one podcast at a time.
Right. No, that applies to me so much these days. This is a special Fast and Furious edition of Movies, Films, and Flicks. Movies, Films, and Flicks is always Fast and Furious, but for this episode, we're going a little bit faster, a little bit more furiouser. We couldn't call it Too Fast, Too Furious, because that name was already taken somehow.
So we're going to call it Really Fast, Really Furious, yeah. Really Knowledgeable, Really Emotional.
Yeah. No, look for that title on iTunes.
Yeah. How about Adroit and Enraged?
Well, that's pretty good. Well, before we get the engines going. Yeah, you like that? Oh, yeah. Let's. We actually have reader questions. Levengood, I think you fielded some pretty good listener questions this week, right?
We do. I've fielded a couple from Twitter. And even though this is the Fast and the Furious podcast special, we are just doing listener questions from my horror followers. And our first question, they helped us out last week as well, is from @DemonScribblers. And @DemonScribblers from Twitter asks, who do the Ghostbusters call?
All right. So I got a simple answer for this, and it's Liam Neeson.
Oh, just straight throat punch in the poltergeist, huh?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about Liam Neeson and Taken 1, Taken 2, Taken 3, nonstop, walk among the tombstones, run all night, unknown, he's always on his phone, he's texting, he's driving, he's threatening it. So imagine you're a Ghostbuster, right? You're Bill Murray, you're Kristen Wiig, you're having some trouble with some ghosts. You just hand the phone, you give the phone to the ghosts and have them talk to Liam Neeson.
So, all right, first off, all those movies you mentioned, I feel like you said Taken 1, Taken 2, Taken 3, Taken 4, Taken 5, Taken 6, and Taken 7.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. But so we actually discussed this briefly last week, in fact, but when it comes to ghosts and Liam Neeson throat punching, can Liam Neeson come in contact with the ghost?
Listen, Liam Neeson's trained his entire life to take out enemies of any kind. Right.
I mean, you could have a ghost. Poltergeist that's hundreds of years old. Who knows how many Liam Neesons that they've killed?
Yeah. I just imagine Liam Neeson training with one of those punching bags, but it's a ghost punching bag.
It's, okay. The punching bag itself is incorporeal, yep. But he hits it anyway.
Yeah.
So it's like he's just punching nothing, but you keep hearing, ow, ow.
No, you see ow. The punching bag going back and forth like he's hitting it. He's the only one that can hit it in the gym. Everybody else in the gym is like, how is he doing that? Like, they're trying themselves, and they're just like, it's just going straight through. And Liam Neeson's just, like, standing in the corner, just like.
But it's like, I think of the ghosts from, like, trying to think of a good example. Like, the Paranormal Activity movies, those ghosts, or that ghost, if it's always just Toby, that jerk Toby. But it, that that ghost, it can manipulate people and hurt people, but no one's ever touching the ghost. Like, no one ever accidentally walks into the ghost when it's in the middle of the room, right? But then you have other ghosts, like the It Follows ghost, and evidently you can, like, physically come in contact with that. So I'm just wondering, like, what kind of ghost can Liam Neeson throat punch?
All right,
like,
so the Ghostbusters need to gauge the situation. So, you know, once they see what kind of ghost it is, they have an ecto taser for that. And if they figure out it's a It Follows or Scary Movie 2 ghost, they'll call Liam Neeson. And if not, they'll call Michael J. Fox and his crew from The Frighteners.
There you go.
Oh.
Or they'll call RIPD.
Oh, no.
Oh, gosh. This actually brings up a pretty interesting question I want to ask you guys. Who would win in the fight, Liam Neeson or the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man?
Oh, Liam Neeson.
No, but if he throat punches it with his speed, it'll just sink right. It'll, like, just pierce right into the Stay Puft.
I imagine Liam Neeson just fiercely climbing the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, trying to get to his throat and trying to, like, choke him.
This is what happens. The Stay Puft Marshmallow Man steps on Liam Neeson, right? And everyone's like, oh, no, Liam Neeson's is dead. And a couple minutes later, you see the Stay Puft looking kind of uncomfortable, like it's about to vomit. And all of a sudden, this massive fist punches through its head. The thing collapses. Liam Neeson surfs the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man like Legolas did in Return of the King on that elephant. And he just walks away. And he's not covered in any marshmallow.
Wow. Wow. I want to see this movie so bad.
Now, I have to point out, Mark, it sounded like you said Liam Neeson's, and I thought of Key and Peele.
Yeah, that's why I did it. I threw a little Key and Peele.
Is Liam Neeson's going to kick some Stay Puft ass?
Yes. Oh, did you see that movie?
Oh, no.
So that's my call. It's either Liam Neeson's or Michael J. Fox and his Frighteners crew.
There you go. I like it. I like it. And we'll just leave RIPD on hold.
No.
And we got to give honorable mention to Key and Peele, though. Any listeners, look up Key and Peele. Liam Neeson on YouTube, and if you like action movies and Liam Neeson, you will adore this skit.
Actually, just watch any Key and Peele, really. Those guys are awesome.
They're the best.
No, I would go with, I was actually going to say the Frighteners, but I'll go with my backup plan and just say Hellboy. Why not?
Oh.
Yeah.
You know what? Because they always find some clever little artifact, like it's a Dungeons & Dragons adventure. Yeah. Like, the Dungeon Master just knew the thing for him to quest for, and he goes and finds it, and now he can fight the ghost.
Yeah. I just want a movie where Bill Murray and Hellboy chill and drink beers and smoke cigars.
I want to see... I think it would be interesting if a Ghostbusters movie directed by Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, that would be fantastic. And a hard PG-13, like, pushing the limits.
Yeah. I don't know. His character, del Toro's character design is just... second to none. I think that would add greatly to Ghostbusters. But no, that's my answer. I think the Ghostbusters should call Hellboy.
I think you're right. Or just call Guillermo himself, just straight up.
Yeah. And Hollywood. Well, I just imagine Bill Murray and Hellboy sharing a cigar, just like drinking whiskey.
Hey, it's guys, like, yo, Del T, how do I handle this?
It's like, hey, guys, you want to help the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man's attacking? Nah, Liam Neeson's guy.
Yeah.
That's fair. All right. Do we have time for another? Are we going to wait for a break?
Yeah, we got another one.
Another one? All right. Yeah. Next one comes from also Twitter, @FilmReactions. Film Reactions asks, what signature horror music is best? Would it be the Halloween theme song, the twist music from the Saw films, or some other musical score?
Jaws.
Oh, that's a good one.
Jaws. Just straight out of the gates with Jaws. I like it.
Well, Jaws is my favorite film. The Jaws log, Jaws art, I've read everything that you can on Jaws. I have everything you could own of Jaws, and I just love the simplicity. I mean, the shark couldn't be on screen that much, so they needed something really strong. And dun 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 dun.
Yeah,
dun,
the music dun, score was dun, really its dun, own dun, character. Dun, 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 I don't know. So, I mean, it's hard to think of ones that aren't, you know, the standard ones, like the Halloweens and all the other ones you didn't mention. I don't know.
Halloween's a good one. Halloween's got a really good.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't John Carpenter? Halloween. Yeah. Didn't John Carpenter actually compose that himself? The Halloween song?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, absolutely. He did.
Wait, that's legit? He did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
I'm impressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did that. And then, I don't know, Morricone did The Thing. That's another Carpenter film. That's kind of
so creepy.
Goldsmith did Alien, Rosemary's Baby. I mean, I don't know, but I'm going with Jaws. Jaws is like, Jaws is the best.
You know, The Thing, like the synthesized score in that was a lot more, I guess, well thought and elaborate than most other movies in the 80s. Usually it was just... You know what I mean? It was they were more abrupt, whereas in The Thing, things were slowly drawn and slowly crescendoed with the synthesizer. It was thoughtful, and that actually makes me think of It Follows.
Yeah, oh, totally. And I mean, what I like about It Follows is it just wears its influences on its sleeve. Like, I compare it to a wonderful – there's a thing called Boo Rye, which is a mixture by High West. It's a mixture of bourbon and rye, and it's just beautiful – blend. And I kind of look at It Follows as a blend of a lot of horror movies, but then it comes out and has its own taste. And so you can tell with the score, the synthesizers, the theme. But yeah, I love that score. And I almost bought, you know, I watched a movie today. I almost went home and bought that score as soon as I got home.
Yeah. And that, I thought that when I saw it, I was in a pretty full theater. I had my girlfriend right next to me, you know, so I there was no sense of being alone. And yet that score crossed with the style of that movie, I felt so isolated and unnerved continuously through the whole thing. How was it for you?
Oh, well, you know, I texted John earlier, and I was in a movie theater by myself on a massive screen. And so I originally kind of had – I got a seat up front because you have to reserve your seats. But I went all the way in the back, checked the rows, and I was all alone in this theater. And you know when you get kind of scared how you hunker down in your chair and your knees start lifting up? Like, I was like that for about a third of the film. I really was. And like, I was just – it's an unnerving experience having the surround sound and a giant screen just by yourself.
When the It That Follows just walks through the doorway, did you ever panic and like kick the seat in front of you as if you were going to kick it away from you?
Well, the previews wreck that. So that's like a scare that I wish I had never seen coming, because I knew that big dude was coming. I think, you know what I love about it? And we won't talk too long about this. I just love urgency and dread and patience. And It Follows had all of those, because that thing is never going to stop. And you have to keep moving. But when you do stop, there's always that fear in the back of your head that it's coming for you. And it's like, I think this, it was just a flop sweat movie for me.
Sure, sure. Hey, you know, just to take about two more minutes on this, I had recently saw the same question happen to come up on Reddit, and people were listing the movies that they liked for good scores on Reddit. So how about we got Genghis Mansion, Oh My Gore, and Undead Dead Guy. They all had their own little bits of input. Let's give a yay or nay after each of their choices. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it.
All right, Halloween.
Yay.
Yay.
Yeah.
Well, obviously. Yeah.
Halloween 2.
I've actually heard it's really underrated, but I couldn't. Yeah.
It's just, yeah. I guess.
So, someone actually went as far as to say Season of the Witch Halloween 3, and come to think of it, that was really different. If you saw that Malcolm McDowell movie, it was really weird, synthesized up. I don't know. I thought it was okay. Creepshow was suggested. That had a fantastic score when they were changing the stories.
Man, I'm drawing a blank right now. I'm just thinking Jaws.
And other people came up with The Thing, It Follows, Poltergeist, Hellraiser. And one person brought up that composer Goblin, who did a whole bunch of Argento's stuff. And, so those were some great suggestions that, you know, completely slipped my mind when it came to great scores. But I just want to thank Genghis Manson, Undead Dead Guy, and Oh My Gore for that, and Film Reactions for the initial question.
Oh, actually, this counts because there were two movies. But Tales from the Crypt, it's a cool score, right?
Oh, yeah.
Demon Knight or Bordello?
They're both the same. They both had the intro, the Tales from the Crypt intro.
Oh, just the Tales from the Crypt theme, yeah. Like from the show.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love that thing.
Yeah, that's like my favorite part of the show.
You take the little journey through the mansion, too, in the beginning of the show. I loved it.
Oh, they should bring that show back. All right. Does that wrap up all the...
Wraps up our introductory reader questions about horror, and we are now on the fast track to fury.
Right, guys. It's time. It's time, guys. You got your engines ready?
Oh, we ain't hungry no more either.
All right, Mark, are you ready?
I'm ready. I got my NOS energy drink.
All right.
I put some NOS on my chair. I got NOS everywhere. If a match goes off, I'm dead.
Levigood, are you ready?
That sounded more like an animal than a car.
Yeah, it sounded like an owner. Yeah.
Are you?
I'd never done an engine sound. I was just trying it right now.
Are you going to ride a wolf right now?
I'm one of the orcs on a warg chasing those hobbitses.
I would love to see that Fast Furious movie. All right, gentlemen. And we're off. Fast and Furious 1, the movie that kicked off the entire franchise. For those of you who don't know, Fast and Furious originally centered on the underground car culture of basically just taking, you know, basically import cars like Hondas or Toyotas and just souping them up. And it was just this movie just basically focused on that culture and made an action movie out of it.
It was a Point Break remake.
Yeah, but with cars.
Yeah.
No, wait, hold on. Mark, you mentioned that actually in a couple of your articles. And when I first read it, I thought, Point Break remake? What's he smoking? And then like 5 seconds passed, and I was like, oh, wow, that it is.
Yeah.
Would you mind going just briefly going over a couple of the parallels there that really caught you with that? Like, when did you have the aha moment?
I mean, I had that aha moment the first time I watched it because I'm such a big fan of Point Break. I had watched that movie a lot. I think I wore out my VHS player, bought the DVD, blah, blah, blah. So when I was sitting in the theater watching Fast and the Furious, I loved every second of it. Don't get me wrong, but I kind of started looking at the parallels of the films. Now, Keanu and Paul Walker were both athletic, undercover FBI agents or cops. They had to infiltrate kind of gangs that were either robbing trucks or robbing banks. They both kind of fell in love with either the sister or a friend. And then at the end, they find out that person is a cop, something happens, and then at the end, they kind of meet at the end, and they both let the bad guys sort of go away. So there's a lot of parallels to the film, but like I said earlier, I don't know, I love good blends. So it was a remake, but it kind of made it its own. And that's, I don't know, you dwell on that, I kind of say it jokingly, but that was when I had my aha moment. Like, what is it? Knowing me, knowing you, uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. No, a lot of people actually, I would say, shared your reaction because the film was a massive surprise box office hit. A lot of people went to go see it.
Well, it was one of the first films that it had just such a wide cast and such a multiracial cast. It was about the undercover car culture. It really appealed to, you know, all my friends had Eagle Talons, Eclipses. They loved the car scenes. And I don't know, I watch it now, and I just love how naive it was compared to Seven now. In Seven, everybody's infallible. They're wrench fighting. They're flying out of helicopters. What I love it, in Fast 1, the biggest problem they had was robbing a truck driver with a shotgun. So, you know, the world has evolved, and the first film just did such a great job of making three-dimensional characters. And I know Paul Walker gets a lot of crap, but he pulled off the action scenes with aplomb. I wrote this post, The Seven Best Moments, and I just love the scene where he initially loses his car to Dominic Toretto to kind of get himself into the gang. So he had this big smile on his face, and while Dom's, like, lecturing him about carburetors, I love the scene where Brian O'Connor's like, "But I almost got you." Like, I love it. Like, he had this big smile. He won over the crowd. He won over Dom. And as much as people make fun of Paul Walker, it was actually, like, really good police work that he did. Like, he got himself undercover and into this gang.
I think you're onto something here with Paul Walker. Paul Walker's chemistry with Vin Diesel, I think, was a major reason for the success of not only this movie, but also the franchise itself. Wouldn't you guys agree?
Yeah. I mean, Paul Walker was, I know this isn't the correct phrasing, but he was kind of the yin to Vin Diesel's yang. Paul Walker was the guy who didn't have the ego, and Vin Diesel very much so did. So you have these two kind of polar opposites bringing each other into the middle. And I just love the teamwork. I thought they were a great combo, and I thought they were really good in this film.
No, I just, you felt the bro love between not only those two characters, but you could tell they probably, you know, liked working with each other in real life. Like, it was just readily apparent.
Yeah, and you know what else? Like, it's like you made the yin and the yang comment. It's like Paul Walker's character was like the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like young, happy, sweeter side, but he was tough when he had to be. Whereas Vin Diesel, he was just like tough all the time, but he had that family sincerity when he needed to have it.
The scene where they're eating dinner and he tells what's his name, like, oh, because you grabbed food first, you have to say grace now.
That's right. Yeah, and he doesn't have friends, he has family.
Ooh. That's right. But like, I don't know, in the first film you established that Paul Walker, he was a good fighter, he fought one of the guys in the gang. I don't know, I just thought that he did really good police work. And I don't know, I think Fast and the Furious did, it was kind of lightning in a bottle. It wasn't Torque, it wasn't Biker Boys, but it established really cool characters. Like Dominic Toretto in that movie made Vin Diesel a superstar. And it just like laid the groundwork and it built a lot of goodwill for the film.
Right.
Series.
Speaking of that goodwill that it built, I think it's time to shift gears and go to Too Fast, Too Furious.
Don't you say that.
What?
All right. So I did a post about the best Fast films, and Too Fast, Too Furious is my favorite.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So,
okay.
You know, Fast and the Furious, right, is a huge hit. Massive hit. And they want to move in to make a sequel. But Vin Diesel goes off and makes a movie called A Man Apart. But, of course, you know, he's all about family, but he's making a movie called A Man Apart, which leaves Paul Walker to team up with Tyrese, who are the best example of friends in the entire Fast series. They're my favorite duo of the group. I think they're hilarious. You know, you got that classic line at the end when Brian O'Connor's like, pockets ain't empty, cuz. And then Roman's like, and we ain't hungry no more either, bruh. Like the whole plot of this movie is them just taking down a smarmy drug dealer, and they steal a cigar cutter. Like in one scene, like that's the big theft, and then Roman gets caught. And I just love, you know, it brought in Ludacris and Tyrese. It kept the series alive, and it brought in Luda and Tyrese, who are still playing big parts today. And it's just a cheeky, fun. I love the fight scene between Roman and Brian when they first meet. Like Roman and Tyrese hits harder, but Paul Walker uses jiu-jitsu, kept him down. Like they just had a great chemistry together, and I think that's what the Fast films are about: friends and family.
I think it's interesting that with the absence of Vin Diesel, when you bring in Tyrese, that Paul Walker was able to almost replicate the chemistry he had with Vin Diesel. Like, it's really good. I think a lot of credit goes to Paul Walker for that. He just seems like a really likable guy that you want to hang out with.
Well, and I know I digress, but I've worked on some film sets, and I know people that he worked in Atlanta here on 5 and 7, and then he worked some movies in Miami. And when I was down there working, when I was here working, everybody talked about how Paul Walker was just the nicest dude. And he would go out of his – and I know it's weird that people applaud people for being nice, but when you work in the film industry, that's kind of rare. And so I think everybody just loved working with him. And what I like about this, Dom and Paul Walker always kind of had like a older brother-brother relationship. But then these two guys were kind of like twins. Paul Walker and Tyrese were like twins, born at the exact time. So one can't be like, I'm older. Like they had a bro relationship, not like a family relationship.
Right. The only things I want to take away from this movie, other than the awesome title, is just Eva Mendes. Holy crap. I'm sorry. I think she was beautiful in that movie. Sorry if I'm not adding too much to that, but yeah, Too Fast, Too Furious.
What do you think about this movie, Loving Good?
You know, honestly, when this movie came out, I was nothing but thumbs down about it. And then later is part 3 came out, and I'll just be upfront and say that was my least favorite of all of them. And so it didn't do anything for me. But then later, when it got reinvigorated down the franchise, I kind of, now that you've said it, I kind of appreciate what part 2 did. It did keep the franchise alive. It reminded us, like, hey, Paul Walker was likable for more than just the first Fast and the Furious movie. It did give us another likable character, and it was just pure popcorn fun. Like I was hating on it back in the day, but I'd leave the TV on when it came on HBO.
Yeah, it's a good TBS movie. Listen, now they're skydiving out of planes, but the plot of Too Fast, Too Furious was a rip off a smarmy drug dealer played by Cole Hauser, and that was it. Like, That's the whole plot. That's the whole plot. You know, the big action scenes revolve around them shooting a guy out of an ejector seat in their car and driving into a boat. It's just fun. Like, I love these two guys. They're fun. Like, Tyrese is always hungry, which played into great jokes on Fast Six with The Rock shooting a vending machine. And I think it laid the groundwork for some great scenes. And I don't know. I love Fast. I don't think it gets the love it deserves. And I've been championing it for a long time.
You know, you talk about the conflict and the stunts and how it got bigger, but you made that shotgun reference back in part one. Didn't what was it? That one dude with the shotgun gave the whole crew a run for their money, didn't he?
Yeah. And he was just driving in a straight line and he brought a shotgun with him and he almost took the entire gang out.
Like, that was it. One dude in a truck with a gun.
One dude, some guy whose face they would never show. He was just always just focused on driving and just reloading his shotgun at the same
time. He was more effectively decimating the crew than what was the guy's name? Than Shaw was in part six.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
if Deckard Shaw was a trucker.
If Shaw teamed up with that trucker, we wouldn't have had a part seven. If he had just hired the trucker, that would have been it.
Wow.
If he'd have been driving that thing in the mountains, that big truck, it would have been all over in the first half hour.
God forbid if he thought to call a trucker's labor union, then that would have been it.
But
hey, speaking of driving in the mountains, that's kind of a convenient segue for the next movie in the Fast and Furious franchise. It's probably the most polarizing, in my opinion, which is Fast and the Furious 3, Tokyo Drift.
Ugh. All right, guys. I just want to, there are a lot of faults with it, but I just want to talk about the positives. It brought in Justin Lin. I love that movie, Better Luck Tomorrow, that he directed.
We should also mention that Tokyo Drift has none. It doesn't have Paul Walker. It doesn't have, well, I guess it has Vin Diesel, but at the end, like a small little cameo. It has like none of the main cast from Fast and Furious for the most part.
So the plot is about an Alabama boy that gets in trouble and he has to go to Japan to live with his dad who is in the military. But the positives are Justin Lin directed it and he went on to direct 4, 5, and 6. And he took the films into another stratosphere. And it also introduced us to Han Solo.
Right. This sounds familiar for some reason. I don't
know. Who is, he had that great relationship with Gal Gadot, Giselle. He has that great scene in Fast Six where Tyrese is always hungry. And Tyrese asks Han for chips. And Han puts his bag upside down because it's empty. It's just real slick. But I like Tokyo Drift. I feel like it took me to another world. Actually, Roger Ebert loved it. He praised it all the time. Wow. And I think it's another, John, we did a poll on our website. We wanted people to vote on their favorite Fast films. And nobody voted for 4 and 6, but we had mostly votes for 1, 5, 3, and 2.
I can give you the exact numbers if you want them. I got them.
Yeah. So you're right. This movie's polarizing. You either love it or you hate it. But I mean, Lucas Black, my wife, I think Lucas Black is from Alabama, but she still thinks his accent is fake. it's a weird little film, and I think expectations hurt it a lot because you were expecting a fast film. But I think it's capably made. I like the drifting. I like the fast girl that was in. I don't know her name. She wasn't fast, but I forget her name. She was really good. Han Solo was a Sung Kang, made a star turn in this film. And so it kept the series alive, and it allowed them time to tread water to bring back Vin Diesel and Paul Walker and to reunite them with Justin Lin.
Right. I just want to mention that Tokyo Drift is unique in that it takes place. It's the third movie that was released, but chronologically speaking, it takes place before the last movie that just came out, Furious 7. So it's actually really confusing. I say don't think too much about it if you're trying to figure it out right now.
Well, if you watch 7, there's a scene where you cut to 3 and it shows Bow Wow and Lucas Black at the end. And Bow Wow's like, hey, there's a guy that wants to meet you. Lucas Black walks out of frame, and then in a matter of seconds, he's 10 years older talking to Vin Diesel. So he's still a high school kid, but he looks like a 34-year-old man. So, it's definitely weird continuity-wise, but I'm glad they kept Han alive because I thought Han was amazing.
So, by the way, Tokyo Drift picked up 15.8% of our votes for the number one Fast and Furious film.
It's way more than I thought it would.
That sounds about right, though, right?
It got 15.8. Too Fast, Too Furious got 10.5, basically 10%. So 10% for Too Fast, Too Furious, 15 for Tokyo Drift.
Oh, Tokyo Drift tied Fast and the Furious, the first one.
Wow. That's right. It did. That also had a 15, 16%. Yeah.
I also want to, when I was doing research on this, I read, someone made a pretty good summary of maybe the reason why this movie is so polarizing compared to the rest of the franchise, is that all the Fast and Furious movies, with Tokyo Drift being the exception, it's the basic plot is basically just all getting the gang together to do like one big job at the end. Tokyo Drift is unique in that the story is basically all about, you know, one guy, a foreigner, trying to become, you know, something greater. In this case, the Drift King. And it's just no other movies in the franchise is like that, story-wise. And I thought that was pretty interesting. I'm like, yeah, Tokyo Drift feels like a different movie, plot-wise. Would you guys agree or no?
Well, I mean, I'd agree, but I think it's because the plot is basically just simple. Like,
right.
I mean, it seems no more complex to me than Torque or Biker Boys. I see what they were doing. They were trying to go global. A lot of times franchises, they try to go international. They try and go global and make the movie feel like it has a greater impact. To me, though, it was just a movie that took place somewhere else. It didn't have the impact that, like, Fast Five did with the Brazil action to me. Right. But whatever. I mean, the comments that Roger Ebert made about it, it's posted on the website. About what the Han character did and the placement in Japan did. Like, okay, you know what? I get it. I can't be too mean to that movie now. It's like, no, you know what? Like, someone said it out loud, and I'm like, oh, shit, you know what? You're right. I guess that is a good point. So, fine. I won't 100% hate on that movie now. All right.
One last thing I wanted to bring up. I'm not 100% sure on this because I think it's a rumor, but is Sung Kang's character, Han, did he also play that character in Better Luck Tomorrow, Justin Lin's first movie?
Like, I want to say yes, because he is the same character, but
the same,
no.
They have the same name, right? It's kind of, right?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Here, I don't know.
I read something that, like, on the Wikipedia that Better Luck Tomorrow is in the same universe as the Fast and Furious movies, which is kind of funny.
All right, at this point, I'm going to make a call to our listeners right now. We are now interested in an intern who will be fact-checking while we are live recording, and then you can signal us. Yeah. You can signal us when you're checking online what we're talking about on IMDb and give us a thumbs up so we can just sound smart and be like, yeah, that's right. It was. Justin Lin did use him as well with the same character.
I like to fact-check during a recording.
So his name was Han in Better Luck Tomorrow. So you know what, guys? John, Levengood, Lezabeth, I'm going out on a limb, all right? I'm going on the high dive. I might be jumping into the shark's mouth here. Okay. But I'm saying it's the same world.
Whoa. So where would...
Mind blown.
So Better Luck Tomorrow... Better Luck Tomorrow is a prequel to the entire Fast and Furious franchise, right?
Well,
yes.
We were basically linking Escape from New York to Big Trouble in Little China and Overboard for the Kurt Russell trilogy of storylines. So, yeah.
Guys.
Yeah, why not?
Guys, yeah, why not?
My mind is blown. I don't know what to say. Other than the fact that looks like we're running low on gas, we might have to take a quick break real quick.
My mind is shattered as one of the gratuitous explosion scenes from Fast 6.
Yeah, Roman and I are going to head to the vending machine real quick.
All right, guys. We'll see you in a little bit.
Hey, guys. Mark here. And for you, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. There's a book that I have to recommend. It's by Eric Larson, and it's called Devil in the White City. It is amazing. I read it 2 years ago. I can't get it out of my mind. I got the audiobook just so I could listen to it again. It's just about the creation of the Chicago World Fair in 1893. And so you have... chapters about the building of the World Fair, and then you have chapters about notorious serial killer H.H. Holmes. This guy was one of America's first serial killers, really bad business, scary as hell, and Eric Larson does this beautiful job of combining the two, and he interweaves the narratives about the building of the World Fair, in which the first Ferris wheel was built, beautiful, and this notorious serial killer. So once again, get this book on Audible by Eric Larson called Devil in the White City. He also wrote the great books In the Garden of Beasts and Dead Wake. So to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. So that was a pretty good break. We refilled on gas. Mark got his snacks. Levin, good. What did you do?
I pretty much just refilled my tasty beverage of Belgian ale in honor of Kurt Russell Day.
Oh, there we go. Awesome. Well, before we get back on the road, so to speak, Lemonade, you have another question for us, right? Yeah, I'll keep the puns. They'll be coming fast and furious tonight.
Let's get off whatever road Lazaveth is on.
we're drifting here. We're drifting.
Hey, yo.
All right, so third and final listener question of the day, again about horror, comes from Kevin Lamb at KLamb12 on Twitter. And K Lamb asks, if Wishmaster was remade today, what improvements would you want to see? Now, being a huge fan of cheap, low-budget, straight-to-DVD horror from the 90s, I'm very familiar with Wishmaster, but I have to wonder if my co-hosts are. are we familiar with Wishmaster, guys?
Not as much as Fast and Furious.
So I will tell you everything that you need to know about Wishmaster. It's from the 90s. It had a shoestring budget. It's so humble. They went for the gold with practical effects gore, and they made any gorehound happy. And it's about this genie that pretty much goes around being a jerk, like totally distorting your wishes. It monkey paws your wishes.
Was it Robin Williams?
It wasn't Robin Williams, okay. No. But I don't know where to go with that.
Did somebody end up with a million ducks?
Nobody ended up with a million ducks.
Okay.
But so this movie, though, again, it was really, really cool. They did a lot with a low budget. It was kind of funny. It was really, really gory and gruesome. And this jerky genie, like, you find the genie, you find the lamp, he's going to give you three wishes. He really wants those wishes. You give him the third wish, he gets to bring hell on earth.
Wait, so do the people know this?
So they end up finding it out during the movie, usually after they make one or two wishes. There are a bunch of these movies. There's four of them now. But
does he mess with them? Like, if you go, hey, I want to be a jumper, like in that movie Jumper, would he actually understand that, or would he twerk it in a way that you're just dead?
He'd find a way to distort it, though. No matter what you do, he'd find a way to lawyer it up and make it horrible.
Jeez Louise.
I thought you wanted to be a bad actor like Hayden Christensen. Hey-o, shots fired.
Oh, we're doing a Jumper podcast in 2 weeks. Just wait, I'll defend that.
Okay.
You know, we could do like a psychic powers one. We could do Push with Chris Evans. We could do Jumper. We could do a couple others.
Right. That'd be interesting. Let's do it. Okay. So Chris, I'm reading here. Is that once in a time before time, God breathed life into the universe, and the light gave birth to angels, and the earth gave birth to man, and the fire gave birth to the jinn, creatures condemned to dwell in the void between the worlds. One who wakes a jinn shall be given three wishes. Upon granting of the third, the unholy legions of the jinn shall be freed upon the earth. Fear one thing only, and all that is, fear the jinn. Jinn, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, all right. So, wouldn't, in order to get the three wishes, sorry guys, I hate to be the dude that's like, I didn't watch it, but.
No, but so, this is kind of fun though, because a lot of people haven't seen this movie.
Wouldn't he be like, hey man, I want $10 million? He's like, here, $10 million. Guys are like, great. Hey, I want to look like Wolverine. All right, yeah, here. Yeah, you're Wolverine. Wouldn't that lead people to do three instead of being like, wait a second, I said I wanted to be like Wolverine, now I'm a furry creature?
Well, but the problem is that as the movie progresses in each of the Wishmaster movies, they end up finding out, because the first wish goes horribly wrong, right? It's not like you get the $10 million. Like, you get $10 million and something awful happens with it. And that's kind of the way that, yeah, the genie kind of goads you into more wishes to kind of solve it, maybe. But you know right away that something's really wrong with these wishes you're getting.
So, but wouldn't it be better if he actually gave you great wishes? Because then you're just like, boom, boom, boom.
You know, for the Hell on Earth thing, yeah, I guess so. But maybe that's just the rub. Get it? Genie lamp. The rub. Yeah.
Okay.
Hey.
Oh, gosh.
The only bad puns will be coming from me.
All right, here's this. The Conjuring 3, because they already have a plot for The Conjuring 2, I think. But they get a hold of this thing. And then the Warrens have to battle this genie. They're on to him. And they're trying to convince this person not to make wishes. But that person's like, hey, man, you know, I need a new suit.
Right, right.
What do you think, John?
I mean,
I just, hold on. Before we continue, if we're going to remake Wishmaster, is it possible to get Kurt Russell to play the genie?
I mean, there's so much makeup involved anyway, so there's really no argument against that.
Well, no, Kurt Russell will just do it. Just as Kurt Russell.
The only thing they wouldn't have to do would be to put monster gloves on him for the genie's sharp fingernail-like big hands, because Kurt Russell already has big monstrous hands.
Okay.
Guys, I got it. Guillermo del Toro, Hellboy.
There it is. You haven't even seen the movie, and you know the best way to remake it is Guillermo del Toro.
Because he deals with the occult a lot, and he does have a lot of themes of religion in his films, or lack of religion. And then you could have Hellboy battling him. And, of course, that he could latch onto somebody and make the wishes terrible. You know, maybe he could attach with one of Hellboy's villains, and each wish is just terrible, and he has to battle through it.
I think that's awesome. I think that's – I was just going to say I want to see a really serious, like, dark version of it instead of a kind of funny low-budget version. The answer from the guy who didn't see the movie is a lot better than mine.
Well, how about this for a twist? In the remake – like, in order to make the wish, it has to also be the name of an 80s album, right?
Wait, so like Danger Zone, like an album?
Yeah, or a song. Just has to be like in, it has to be like in the song name.
So like if your wish is for Danger Zone, you end up dating a redhead named Tiffany who keeps breaking your stuff like whenever you get in a fight.
The genie will automatically understand like what you want, right?
I like it.
So
I like it. Wait, so you make my dreams come true? Is that an 80s song?
That's like a wish within the wish.
Yeah.
That is the wish that explains the wish.
But then the genie would be like, crap, I got to make your wishes actually come true now. You know,
That might be the ultimate wish.
Yeah, that's like a...
Hall and Oates for the win.
What's that movie, Mom and Dad Save the World? It's Hall and Oates Save the World.
Oh, it's there, like, you go. I love Mom and Dad Save the World.
It's like the Kiss movies that are really bad and the Ramones movies that are really bad, except it's Hall and Oates.
Is this still a horror movie? Because we're remaking it. It doesn't seem like a horror movie anymore. It seems like a musical.
It sounds like an awesome movie.
There we go. All right, so it's either Del Toro or Hall & Oates.
Or Del Toro with Hall & Oates starring.
Wow.
As they are now, probably in their, like, 60s.
Wait, as older musicians who want popularity again.
There you go. And they end up with some Milli Vanilli future.
So I gotta say this, guys. We really, John Stockton ourselves, some assists on this. And I want to say good job.
Just high fives all around.
We were John Stockton, we were assisting, we were Karl Malone, and we were Duncan. I mean, we were the Utah Jazz on this answer.
I'm feeling the bro love.
Well, right, and again, you know, it's funny. Only one of the three of us has even seen it, and yet it turned out to be a really fun question. So thanks again to Kevin Lamb at KLamb12 on Twitter.
Yeah.
Appreciate you listening.
All right, guys. I think it's about that time. We get back on that open road, right?
Here I go again on my own. Da, 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 da.
I've ever known. Like Paul. Wait, no, never mind.
All right.
So,
all right. Well, like before we went on break, we were discussing Tokyo Drift. So now it's time to move on to, what do you know, Fast and Furious 4. We saw that one coming, right?
Yeah. So Fast and the Furious 4 is, I think, it is my least favorite. It did bring back Justin Lin. You have Vin and Paul Walker. You brought in Gal Gadot, who was really great. However, well, actually, you bring back Han, too, which is pretty amazing. But the whole action set pieces, aside from that first one with the tanker, are really bad. Like, I think the two main action scenes in this film revolve around them driving through caves. And you're like, what? Like, it's the same action scene twice. There's some guy named Braga. He's some drug dealer. And it's just, I don't know. It's a bunch of hooey. But I still love it.
I think people were really excited when it was first announced because it brought back kind of the main cast. You know, Paul Walker, Vin Diesel. I think Vin Diesel especially. He was missing since the first movie. Mm-hmm. So it did. Yeah. This movie did pretty well at the box office.
Oh, it made $70 million in its opening weekend. Right. I mean, it had legs. Yeah. So, and listen, guys, when I say that I don't like this movie, it's like me rating Girl Scout cookies. I love every kind of Girl Scout cookie. And so for me to say one's my favorite and one's my least favorite doesn't mean I don't like the seventh-ranked one. It just means that I like Samoa's the best.
So what flavor Girl Scout cookie is Fast and Furious 4, Mark?
It's the Samara from The Ring is what it is.
Oh, yeah.
That's the flavor. It's Samara.
Samara. It is... It's the tagalongs of the series.
Okay. No, I like tagalongs. What are you talking about?
Well, see, that's what the Fast and Furious series does. Everyone's torn about it. So you talk about Girl Scout cookies, everyone's like, no, I don't like that. I like this. So perfect.
When this movie came out, like, I was excited, right? Because, well, again, I was not a fan of part two. Part three just crushed my inner child and made me not want any more of these movies. And then this came out, and it brought the serious back. It had a budget. You could tell by the trailer. It had a budget. Had the original cast back, you know, the gangs back together. So I was really, really stoked about it. And I agree. I ended up being a little disappointed rather disappointed with the action sets and what they were doing in it. But it did reignite my interest. It got the gang back. It had a budget, and it was serious again.
Yeah, I mean, Gal Gadot was awesome in it. Then she had that great relationship with Han, and it had that really cool chase scene with Paul Walker in this film. So he was back kind of doing his stuff. So it brought the gang back together. It was like a John Stockton assist in Karl Malone's Slam Dunk Part 5.
I think the most notable thing about this movie is that this movie is really the first movie that in the franchise that kind of starts to shift away from, you know, a movie being about like the underground car culture to just a full out like action franchise, right?
Yeah, oh, big action, yeah. Heisty thing.
Yeah, it got involved with like drugs and then La Braga, then espionage and all the cops. So yeah, it definitely started taking the thing into another direction.
I don't really blame him because how much could you really wring out of like how many movies can you really make about just like Honda Civics, really?
It's like, you know. I think you're right. I think it took a baby step in a lot of this action, so then 5 wasn't as ridiculous.
Right. Fast 5. We're moving on.
No, oh, my gosh.
I know. But Fast 5 was...
One of the best movies ever.
Yeah, if Fast and Furious 4 was baby steps, Fast 5 was just like a full-out leap into the Grand Canyon as far as like action goes. And like the biggest thing they did... to signify that they've gone full out action is cast a rock.
Oh yeah.
Oh man. It's just, dude, this is like Ocean's 11 on Corona, Nas and steroids. And I love this film. I think I love it. And in the posts about Paul Walker's 7 best moments, he has two of them in this film. Now, what I love about Fast 5 is it starts defying gravity and logic a lot more than the other films. And in the beginning scene, Dom is headed to prison, and his family comes out to save him. So Brian and Mia, they work together. Oh, Jordana Brewster, who's given a short trip in this pod, she's been great. So, but they somehow manage to flip a bus like 12 times, rescue Dom, and kill nobody. So remember that scene in Fast 5 where they flipped that bus and nobody died?
Yeah, that was the beginning of the movie, right?
Yeah, but I watched it again, and Paul Walker, he has to wait. So Mia drives at the bus, makes it swerve. Paul Walker has to wait in front of an out-of-control bus in order for it to hit his car and go into a spin. So he almost gets crushed so he can help his family. And what's the biggest theme of the Fast movies? Family. So Paul Walker's timing, flipping this bus and making it flip 12 times, killed nobody.
I think that sounds about right.
That was the first of very reasonable stunts in the movie.
Paul Walker and Vin Diesel are such good drivers that they take a safe through Rio and kill nobody.
Ooh, I want to talk about that scene. They're literally dragging a huge safe throughout the streets of Rio.
That was pretty awesome.
Yeah. It was just, as I was watching that, I remember thinking, like, man, there's probably like a physicist watching this, and he's just like totally just like
loving it.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, nobody died. Nobody in this. The safe missed everybody. But see, I think Dom and Brian are such good drivers that no one died. They knew what they were doing.
So you think they practiced this just like eventual scenario?
Absolutely.
Like,
they know what they're
to, yeah,
honestly, when I was watching this and I saw what happened to some of those cop cars, I never watched this under the idea that no one died. I watched that thinking that many police officers died.
No, they did an announcement later on, like, nobody died.
No police officers' characters died in the making of this movie.
It's like in what's that, Bad Boys 2, when there's a gunfight between 100 people with automatic guns, and then there's a news broadcast reported later going, no cops or citizens were killed. It's like, what?
Okay. But,
so, also, my favorite scene of all the Fast movies involves, so they're on this train, Mia, Dom, and Brian are on this train, and it all goes wrong. And there's a scene where they're on the speeding train. Paul Walker's hanging on this car that crashed through the train that's on fire, right? Dom gets his car out of the train, starts driving. Brian jumps onto the back of this beautiful car, and together the two of them drive off a cliff, fall a quarter mile, and land perfectly in water beneath them. But the best part is, if you're ever looking at the site on Paul Walker's 7 Best Moments, if you watch the GIF, the look, Paul Walker is surfing a car, and the look on his face, he like times it. He knows exactly when to jump. He knows exactly how to land, and he looks so chill, like he's done it a billion times before.
You think that was just sending a message to Keanu? Like, I bet Keanu can't do this.
Wait, so like, just for a decade, Paul Walker's just dissing Keanu?
Yeah.
Like, hey, watch, you can surf surfboards. I surf the car.
Oh, but the first Fast and Furious was just a Point Break remake, huh? But watch this. I think the whole time he's thinking, like, he's like thinking to himself, like, how you like them apples, bro?
Yeah, how you like them apples. So what do you think about this movie, Loving Good?
It's absolutely my favorite. It is hands down, no comparison, no thought involved, my favorite. Even right after I saw 6, 5's my favorite. Right after I saw 7, 5's my favorite, hands down. And the biggest thing for me, that safe scene, the dragging the safe scene, you know, it doesn't matter if people died or not. How much fun was that? You know, and honestly, you know, whatever physics they were defying, it wasn't obvious to me. I just knew that something was probably up, but I didn't know what exactly, and I like that. But for me, man, it was the best fight of the whole series, and it's The Rock against Vin Diesel. And I thought they couldn't make that work. I didn't think it could work. Because Vin Diesel's like 6 feet tall, 200 pounds. The Rock was coming in right after like Pain and Gain at like 260. I didn't believe it was a credible fight. I thought that The Rock could kill 3 Vin Diesels.
Stacked on top of each other.
And so when they meet face-to-face, right, like clearly it's almost like when Mel Gibson's going to kiss someone in a 90s movie, they put him on lifts so they look like they're eye-to-eye, or like a Tom Cruise movie. Like, they make it look like he's taller. So they made it look like they were face-to-face. But I still, even then, I'm like, no, it's not going to work. And that fight worked. The hits were all hard. It was dynamic. They were knocking through shit. No one was taking hits that I didn't really think they could take. People were dodging the hits that I didn't think they could take. And I didn't like that Vin Diesel won, just as a Rock fan. But at the same time, I loved it. And the other thing about that, and I'm sorry, I'm really ranting, but me and The Rock, it's got The Rock involved, I get pumped up, is that The Rock from the very start felt simultaneously like a protagonist and an antagonist. Even though later he becomes a good guy, in the beginning he's an antagonist to our team, but I was rooting for him the whole time.
I felt the same way when I was watching him in WWE.
There you go. See, the Rock for the win. So, I mean, I just dropped a mother load, Mark, including that this was the best fight, I thought, and the best movie, I thought, with the best action sequence, I thought. React.
I will say that when I first heard that The Rock was going to be in Fast Five, I had my doubts. I felt like he just wouldn't fit, like, literally and figuratively.
Because he's large, yeah. He wouldn't fit.
Yeah, but no, I keep underestimating The Rock's ability to charm the hell out of you. You know,
he's the most electrifying man in entertainment.
Exactly. He fit in with the rest of the cast and crew like it was like he's been there since the first movie. I thought it was a great addition.
Well, and he's like, if there's a yin and a yang, he's like the I don't know, the combination of those, because he has
he's the guy who pushes them together.
Yeah, and he doesn't really have that ego. I think he's just there having a good time. Yeah. And I don't know. The fight scene that you were talking about, I guess my main problem with it is I feel like they should have just added Godzilla sound effects, because they were just they were like plowing through walls and like and I don't know. And then Dom had to get the victory because Dom can never lose, and I feel like the ego sort of came in there a little bit and it got built up throughout the series. And my favorite fight scene is Paul Walker in the prison scene from Six. But oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, though, this fight was epic. They destroyed that set. I loved every moment of this film.
Right.
You compared it to, in the beginning, to an Ocean's 11 film. And I got to say also, I thought that when they came together to problem solve, like, I felt more included as an audience member in, like, figuring out or agreeing with their decisions. Whereas in, like, 6 and 7, I felt like they were just telling us what they were doing in the movies.
They should put The Rock in the next Ocean.
Absolutely. I mean, more ego got involved. And then they were like, you know, in Fast 6, they're just in these cars chasing a terrorist. And you're like, what? Like, Fast 5 is just about them getting together to do a robbery. And they're still, like, pretty scared about it.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about Fast 6, let's start focusing on Fast 6 now. Actually, no, it's actually called Fast and Furious, right? Was that the official Fast and Furious?
6. I thought it was Fast 6.
Was it Fast 6?
No, it was Fast 5.
Fast 5, Fast and Furious, and then Furious 7?
And then Fast and Furious 6.
I thought it was just called Fast and Furious. Oh, God. We're not going to sell this tonight, are we?
It's Fast and Furious 6.
Okay.
Which, by the way, got 0 votes for the number 1 in the franchise. Hmm. But I'll bet that if we had people order them, that it wouldn't have come up in last place.
Yeah. It's just, we were talking about this the other day, John, and the movie started off really weird for me because there's this scene where The Rock goes in to interrogate a guy, this guy who's a Vin Diesel, Dominic Toretto doppelganger. And this is where I can watch cars fly off cliffs. I can watch cars drive through buildings. But there's this scene where The Rock picks him up over his head and throws him through the ceiling. He throws him 10 feet into a wall. And this is I feel like this is where the series gets a little bit too like
comic booky.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, once again, I always love Paul Walker in these movies because he keeps him grounded. And my favorite part of 6 is that the fight inside the prison when he goes to the guy from 4, Braga, and he goes into the prison and he gets locked in there with 4 dudes and he has this close quartered fight that's just badass. And that's like my favorite because he can't throw people through walls. He doesn't know how to wrench fight like in Fast 7. He has to use like actual skills to win. And I just love that fight. But, yeah, I don't know. The plot of this is weird. What is it? Owen Shaw, this terrorist, has a bad team that's exactly like the good team. And then The Rock is in it. And then they all join forces so they can get their records expunged. And they go to London. They go all over the place. And it has the world's longest runway. I think it's probably like a 30-mile runway. World's largest plane. Cars are driving through planes. I love it. Don't get me wrong. But I just don't think it's 5 level.
I agree very much. And as a huge fan of The Rock, I was also rather lost in that fight scene where he was kind of throwing the guy up in the ceiling with one arm almost. I don't like that superhuman strength stuff. I like practical but brutal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it lost me there. You know, Mark, you wrote about 3 sentences about Fast 6 that really hit home for me, not just because they were hilarious, but because they really seem to summarize the movie to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I wrote, it throws in the kitchen sink, then blows it up with a tank. Then it rains kitchen sinks onto the tank, and somehow Vin Diesel still manages to catch a free-falling Michelle Rodriguez. I love Fast 6, but it lives and dies by the adage, much more is better. I love the car work Paul Walker does, and listening to Tyrese asking for change so he can buy food from a vending machine. I can't get through that sentence. Always cracks me up. Fast 6 is much like the runway at the end. It is too long and excessive.
Can I talk about that runway like scene?
Yeah, do it, please.
You know, I think, by the way, that we've underestimated how long that runway is. Like, you said it was like 3 miles. With how fast they were probably going and how long that scene was, I feel like that had to be like an 8 mile runway.
Well, okay. Someone actually did the math, right?
Wait. So you did the research, John?
Well, I didn't do it. I'm just picking back off someone else's research.
We want to hire them as our intern.
Yeah. Well, it's this image is floating around imagery.com. How big is the runway in Fast and Furious 6? So someone estimated that the speed that the plane was going was 115 miles per hour. The time that they spent on the runway was about 15 minutes, right?
So like 27 miles?
Yeah, it comes out to 28.75 miles. To put that in perspective, the world's longest runway is 3.4 miles.
Wait, that's like as wide east to west as the state of Connecticut.
Yeah. So they spent the last 15 minutes of the movie driving across the state of Connecticut.
I mean, it's a very small state, but it's a state nonetheless.
and now that we've gone about the runway, but Paul Walker, he's the one that actually figures out how to take the plane down because he shoots around it into the engine. What's up?
Took him long enough.
Yeah. But, they got across the Connecticut state line. Why Vin is driving cars to rescue Letty from a tank flying across a bridge and The Rock is throwing people through buildings. Paul Walker has my favorite moments. Like, there's a scene where Walker first showed his getting rid of electronic car killer skills in Too Fast, Too Furious. He perfected the skill in Fast 6. So there's a scene where Ludacris and Tyrese had already been taken out by the devices, and Walker was the last one left chasing that SUV because the guy was shooting those electronic things at the car that killed him. So Paul Walker knew that the device was capable of shutting off his car, so he pulls this like emergency brake maneuver and he just gets rid of the projectile on this wall. And it's just like this really smart moment that proved he can like think fast while thinking fast. I just love that scene. So you got all these people jumping cars and throwing people through buildings, but then you got Paul Walker using his brain to save the day by getting rid of this thing that could kill his car. And that's like Paul Walker's roles in this film in a nutshell. It's like really great moments, really great thinking scenes, but they're always overshadowed by The Rock's breaking casts just by flexing.
So Paul Walker in Fast and Furious 6 is like Neo in The Matrix Reloaded, when Neo kills all those little octopus robots by using his power to duplicate an electromagnetic pulse.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So we are going back from Paul Walker to Keanu. These guys are related. But yeah, guys,
go ahead.
I'm nonplussed. I'm sorry. You go ahead.
I keep going back to these Paul Walker scenes, but I don't know, man. I always thought he just grounded these for me, and he was always about the family. And I know I love in 6 how Tyrese was worried about the chips. Oh, guys, what about at the end where Giselle saves Han's life by sacrificing herself?
I was going to ask you how you felt about that because that scene just made me angry.
Oh, I think they had to kill her off because Han got killed in Tokyo Drift.
Yeah.
But I was just like, she saved her man. Like, she's such a badass and she was so cool. And it like really like got me choked up.
I felt really bad for Han because you could tell like it was just, well, I mean, it was really good acting on Sung Kang's part, but like still, it was just like, he was just heartbroken. I'm just like, ugh.
Yeah, and at the end, they're all drinking barbecue. You know, they're all drinking Corona, drinking barbecue where they put it in blenders.
Yeah.
But they're drinking Corona, they're eating barbecue, and they're talking about family. And there's Han by himself after just losing the love of his life. And everyone's like, you'll be all right.
Then, like, rough. He's like, oh, I'm moving to Japan. And it's like, no, don't do that. Yeah. It's just a double whammy of sadness. I was like, ugh.
Oh, gosh. But, yeah, she was such a good character, that Giselle. And, oh, dude, Gina Carano and Michelle Rodriguez had that great fight in 6.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She was a great addition.
Oh, no, man. And then the Sung Kang Tyrese fight where they fought the guy from the raid.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That fight. So it's, you got those two guys, right? Either of them are bigger than their little Asian culprit. And that dude did a credible job of beating the crap out of both of them without looking too perfect, but it was still totally credible. There was no comic book BS. Like, I bought it all. I loved that fight. That fight for me is right below The Rock and Vin Diesel. Right.
Yeah, and I love at the end of it, they're just like, let's not talk about this.
Yeah. It was like Tyrese does good at bringing in that. Yeah.
All right, guys. Yeah. Well, I think it's time to shift in the top gear here. I think we're cruising along, but it's time to hit top speed. That's right. The puns are still there. I got plenty of them. Fast. Actually, it's just called Furious 7, right?
Yeah, Furious 7.
God, it's the waiting.
It's not about being fast anymore.
Yeah, it's just Furious. I don't know. The last, or not the final, but the most recent Fast and Furious movie was just released recently in the past couple weeks. We've all had a chance to see it. What's everyone's general impressions?
So I started off my article. I wrote Furious 7, a fantastic film that breaks out the Belgian beer but never strays too far from the joys of Corona. So, John, you want to talk to us about Kurt Russell, our homeboy Kurt Russell?
Well, look. So of all the random things that were shoehorned into this movie, which, by the way, was a popcorn delight. This was a spectacularly fun movie. But when I saw Kurt Russell and how he was presented, I was equally rolling my eyes and high-fiving. Like, I didn't know how to totally react. Because he comes in all smooth, and he has all the answers, and he has a fancy Bond name, like Mr. Nobody. And he helps them find the best surveillance tool in the universe. It was like Eagle Eye. And then he says, Dom, I need your guys, even though we know there are a bunch of people who screw up a lot of the times, and you can do whatever you want. So it was all this fantasy stuff. I felt like it was a 13-year-old's fantasy. But at the same time, it's Kurt Russell. I'm pulling apart here, and he's making comments about to an ex-mechanic, ex-con, car racer, musclehead about trying Belgian beer over Corona for a change, but he knows he won't change, right? What does he do, Mark? What does he do when he knows he won't change?
So Vin's like, I only drink Corona. And Kurt Russell pulls out a six-pack of Corona on ice and hands it to Vin out of nowhere.
Like, he didn't even finish. Vin didn't even finish his sentence.
And he has a bucket of Corona in his hands.
It was like they already had the pops topped, like a bartender just handed him over the bar.
And there's a scene where Kurt Russell's kind of in some trouble. You know, he got hurt. And he looks at Vin. He's like, I got to tell you something, Vin. Or Dominic. You really got to try that Belgian beer.
But yeah, I mean, Kurt Russell, he really did. He strolled out like a good version of a Bond villain, and they replaced his evil Bond villaininess with pretentious beer drinking and like all the reserve of a Spy Kids bad guy. And I don't know, like, but it was in a good way and a little bit of bad, but maybe mostly good. It was a lot of fun. And yeah, Dom, I need your misfits. Do whatever you want with this device that the government needs more than anything, but I'm just going to hand it to you right now.
I don't have friends. I have family. And how about the introduction to Jason Statham? So Jason Statham's in the hospital Deckard Shaw is in the hospital talking to his brother Owen Shaw, who survived at the end of Fast 6 for some reason, but Giselle couldn't. And you cut to how Jason Statham got into the film, where he walks out and he killed, 100 guards?
You'd think he had to have a team of 5 Jason Stathams, all as cool as he was in this movie, to do that.
I mean, where are the cops at? And see, that's another ego thing that really annoyed me. You had Statham's ego, and then you had Diesel's ego. And it led to this final fight where they fight with wrenches. And it's like wrench foo, but Diesel could have just killed him and helped his team. And then there's like that weird amnesia side plot with Michelle Rodriguez. I don't know.
There was. It should also be mentioned that, for those of you who didn't already know, but Paul Walker died during the middle of filming this movie. So that kind of, I think that kind of just ruined, not really ruined, but just kind of I guess there were certain things that they obviously had to change, right? Yeah. So the plot feels a little bit mishmash, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, they were going to build into eight with the Kurt Russell character, but I love it, man. I love that this huge, huge series, billion-dollar series, changed their entire thing to just honor a guy. They basically broke the fourth wall, and they just gave him – like, all right, so I watched that Parks and Rec series finale, and I love that show, and it was so good I didn't feel bad about the show finishing because they just nailed it. And this ending of Fast 7 was just so classy. Spoilers, you know, whatever. They fade to white. They retire him from the series, and it is just the coolest, nicest – I don't know. I thought they handled it really well. Of course, I don't know. Vin Diesel had to interject himself in it, but they had this original song. It was just such a great finale and send-off for Paul Walker.
Yeah, I honestly think that the ending they came up with was the best possible ending you could make regarding, you know, the circumstances. You know, it's just you pay respect to not only the character but also the actor himself, who I think is one of the main reasons why the franchise is where it is today, right? Fast and Furious wouldn't be what it is if not for Paul Walker.
No. I read this this thing from Vulture the other day talking about his acting, and he said that while a lot of actors seem very not sure of themselves and they don't really fit into their skin, he said Paul Walker just knew exactly who he was. He knew who he was as an actor. And they said that he could just – he had this role down and he just could have chemistry with anybody. And I think that was him. He had great – whenever he was in a scene with somebody, it always worked out really well. I don't think sometimes he was helped by the fast scripts because notoriously they have all been pretty wonky but beautiful. But yeah, no, I think he's just as big a part of this film. He's one of the reasons people love these movies.
Yeah. He always exudes this kind of down-to-earth aura. I think there's this one quote they had. I'm probably going to paraphrase heavily here. But he says, like, you know, regarding the paparazzi culture around celebrities, he says, like, you know, if you want to live in some place like Hollywood or Beverly Hills, you know, you have to expect paparazzi. If you don't want to deal with that, just move to some place like Ohio. Seriously.
You know, no, he got it. He had, you know, he did charity work. He had his own island. I don't know. He just sort of understood it. And I don't know. I liked Brian O'Connor was my favorite part. And the ending of Fading to White was just brilliant. What do you think, John?
I mean, I thought the ending, you know, there was some sappiness to it. But I mean, it captured what it had to capture. And they were trying to include as many people as they could in the audience. And so I get why they did it the way they did it. It was very sweet. Of course, all the fans who went to see it already knew about Paul Walker. And so when we all saw it, you know, it was kind of hitting home. It wasn't just like a nice little ending to a movie. I mean, we all knew it was an honorarium.
Right? Yeah.
And so, yeah, it felt good. You know, the little race at the end seemed a little tacky, but it was still sweet. You know, it worked.
You know, Vin interjected himself. But, you know, we're talking about this, but you know who else? Like, we're never going to be able to cover all this, but we've also left out that Tony Jaa's in this movie. Ronda Rousey. So my favorite scene of this film is the fight scene. I don't want to spoil everything. Should we?
By the time this is out, people will have seen it.
Paul Walker and Tony Jaa have a fight scene, right? And kind of Tony Jaa gets the first victory, and he looks at Paul Walker and goes, too slow. And that's the scene where Paul Walker has to climb through the bus and run and catch the car driven by Letty. But the second fight between Tony Jaa and Paul Walker is just this awesome fight, practical fight, believable fight. But it ends with Paul Walker attaches this rolling wheel of, I don't know.
Heaviness.
To Tony Jaa, kicks it down an elevator shaft and looks at Tony Jaa and goes, too slow. And with this big smile on his face, and he kills one of the greatest martial artists of our time. And, like, I loved every second of it. I almost picked up the guy in front of me and ran around the theater.
And anyone who's confused right now by this name, Tony Jaa, yeah, Ong Bak, The Protector, he did Ong Bak 2 and 3 after that. He's got more stuff coming out. But he did for Muay Thai what the movie The Raid did for Salat,
yeah, or what Rocky did for boxing.
Yeah, boxing. But I mean, he's an amazing acrobat. He's got Jackie Chan like skills for jumping off walls. I mean,
fantastic martial artist, and he kind of fell off the radar a little bit, and this movie is sort of like his mainstream comeback.
And just, you know, Ronda Rousey didn't have much of a part. Gina Carano, I thought, was used better in Fast and Furious 6. Right. But, like, that car scene where they drove through the three buildings, this Vulture article did a thing where they said it was kind of plausible that it could happen. Like, it wouldn't, but it could. So it's, like, one of the more believable stunts of the movie.
If the car is fast enough and light enough, I think it, well, I don't know, maybe.
0-60 in 3 seconds?
Yeah. Oof. I don't know. All right, guys, so the finish line is in sight. That's right. The puns are still there.
Okay. Oh, no.
Before we cross it, do we have any final thoughts on the entire franchise? Any final thoughts?
So it started off with them. I mean, in 2001, getting dressed up meant wearing a clean sleeveless shirt for the Fast Gang. But in 2015, our heroes are rocking tailored suits to parties in Abu Dhabi, in which they drive a $4 million car through three buildings.
Living good?
I think that they went from really simple plots about racing and family to really global plots that gave us some of the most amazing action sequences of the decade, or at least the most fun, if not technically the greatest, while still clinging to the strong sense of that family purity. So I like how they ended up. Can I ask, are we certain, based on the rumor mill, that they're not going to continue the series with what would have been the Kurt Russell, the new trilogy of Fast and Furious?
I heard they were.
Yeah, they're going to bring him back. There was an interview recently with Vin Diesel where he said he wants to get back with Vin Diesel's Kurt Russell's character.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that this just shows, I don't care if he's in the movie or not, we can't seem to get through a podcast without Kurt Russell. So Kurt Russell we trust. You know?
Why would we want to? But listen, I will still say that Too Fast is my Fury. Is my Furious?
Yes, Too Fast is your Too Furious.
You are the Fast to my Furious.
So here's my rankings. Too Fast, Too Furious is my favorite, followed by 5, 3, 1, 7, 6, and 4.
Are those the lost numbers?
Yeah. So, hey, John, did I change your minds a little bit about 2 and 3?
I kind of keep them in the same very low place in my rankings, but I respect them a lot more.
Yeehaw!
You got me thinking about them a lot the last couple weeks.
And honestly?
And they went from honestly being disrespected to just being my least favorites and not necessarily disrespected.
I actually want to watch Tokyo Drift again for some reason.
I will never say that, though.
I think for me, as far as like my feelings towards the whole franchise, when the first Fast and Furious movie came out, it was a movie about, you know, tuner cars and that whole culture. I was never into it, but I had a lot of friends that were, so I had kind of an insight into the culture. Like, I felt like I never saw a movie that was more in tune into its target audience. Like, it just knew it just knew like the people that were going to watch it, and they knew exactly what to give the audience. And as the series evolved, like, they still knew how to entertain and please like the people that they knew were going to watch this movie. So I feel like, you know, Fast and Furious, all the movies, like, they're not the best movies ever, but they will entertain you because they know exactly how to do it, or how to push your button, so to speak. Well, that's my thoughts.
You know how to hit the NOS button?
Yeah, exactly.
But Fast Five is one of the best movies ever. Oh. Fast Five is Fast Five is my next generation Fifth Element.
Wow.
It's one of the best action films of the last 10 years, for sure.
Yeah, it is. All right, guys. Oh, real quick, before we sign off, I have to ask this question because it's Fast and Furious podcast. Which was your favorite car out of all the movies? Oh, come on. You guys don't have one?
Well, it's Vin's from the first one.
The Charger.
Which he drives in. Yeah, the Charger, yeah. Obviously. He drives it in the train wipes it out.
Love it good?
Like, oh, the Charger.
Okay.
I'm really not so much a car person. I thought it was... I loved, though, not the car itself, but I love that Jason Statham is driving around in the most expensive car that we've ever seen in the series, and he keeps totaling it, and then he appears with another, and he totals that one. Like, where is he getting these? Where do they come from, these cars that he's totaling?
He's a ghost.
He's like this video game boss, and it's like, why do you need to track Shaw when he keeps finding you? And why do you need to keep running away from him when you want to kill him?
I actually have a couple favorites. Obviously, I have Vin's Charger. I also like Brian's GTR, but I think after watching a new movie, I think my favorite is the ambulance the Rock drives and crashes into the drone.
He times the Rock flies or drives an ambulance off a bridge onto a drone.
Seriously, how awesome is that?
Daddy's got to go to work.
All right, guys, and we just crossed the finish line. Four. Hey,
what? Three-way tie?
I think I came out ahead, but yeah, we'll go.
I almost had you.
Oh.
I almost got you.
Oh, I almost had you.
Oh.
Oh, I love it.
For my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
John Wick forever.
John Levengood.
And Kurt Russell, we trust.
I've been your host, John. Oh, I forgot to do plugs. All right. Plugs real quick.
Keep it rolling. Moviesfilmsandflicks.com, guys. Moviesfilmsandflicks.com.
And sharkdropper.com. Sharkdropper.com.
Follow us on Twitter, RadarPod. Visit Sharkdropper.
Yeah.
Talk about Kurt Russell.
You can now find us on OneCast for your mobile app.
Oh, yeah. That's right. All right, guys. So we're definitely past the finish line now. All right, guys. We'll see you later.
Thanks for listening.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! 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 This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.